This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
The second topic, this panel, will be chaired by Peter Reid. It's called These Are Modern Dreamtime Stories, which, of course, you will now be able to relate to it, the expression as coming from the mouth of Richard Bell in the film you saw just before lunch. And it's really looking at how culture and identity is expressed again in these in Indigenous environments. So whilst we're talking labels in one way, we're really talking about different modes of expression, expressing your experience as Indigenous peoples. And then what significance the art movement has had on urban dwellers and how it can be better read as documentary tools, so it's sort of beyond art into sort of forms of documentation, or in fact, as Wesley said, you know, writing on the public record. So I'm not going to say any more. I'm going to leave. Oh, just to let you know that unfortunately, Jennifer Hurd, despite her absolute best efforts, had a bit of a family crisis, and up till midnight last night, she was still going to try and make it this morning, but things have conspired against her. So she sends her apologies. And for those who don't know, Jennifer Hurd is one of the Proper Now group with Richard Vernon, Tony Albert et al. So we're going to pop Stephen into that slot. So we're starting off with Gordon, and then there'll be Stephen and then Samuel. Okay, Peter.
Thanks, Margot. Phones off, everyone, including me. Hey, wasn't that a great session this morning? What a ripper. We're really getting into it, I thought. A nice, really nice feeling and doing some really serious talking as well. I thought it was just terrific. Hey, do you remember that painting that used to be in all the legal services a few years ago? You saw it everywhere, the calendar. Judgment by his peers. It was the that white fella in the dock, a black judge. Black jury, black ushers, black everybody's. Wasn't it powerful? Remember that? Well, Uncle Gordon's the author of that. He's got three paintings down there for us as well. So this session, we're really talking about cultural expression still, but all in actual particular. We're talking about novels and artistic expression, films and plays. So our first speaker is Gordon Syron, and he says this. He's made many significant contributions to his community as co-founder of the Yorra College with Bobby Merritt and the first art teacher there, president of the Deaths in Custody Watch Committee in the late 1990s. From 1997 to 2007, his gallery, Blackfellas Dreaming, supported and encouraged new, young and struggling artists. Uncle Gordon's known for his political and historical oil paintings. He's a self-taught artist who's carved himself a remarkable career which has influenced his peers in the artistic, political and cultural arenas. Darren Cooper states that he dreams for all of us. The extent of Gordon Syron's work was seen in two retrospectives, the first in 1998, another one in 2004 at the Australian Museum, Sydney. He's been invited to exhibit paintings in Paris in September and in Dubai in October 1997. And being a real artist, he's not using any of this sort of newfangled stuff on the board here. We're looking at the real paintings. They're down the front. I don't know if you can see them there. If we can't see them too well, anything you're talking about, I can sort of hold it up or something if we can't see it too well. Thanks, Uncle Gordon. Welcome to the podium.
Hello. My name is Gordon Syron, and I don't do welcome to country or anything like that because I guess I'm too civilised or too much of an urban Aboriginal. But I wish to talk about living with the invaders, and I wish to discuss why Aboriginal people are angry. The Australian people have taken so much culture from us Aboriginal people that soon there will be none left to take. Howard refuses to say sorry because he is not genuinely sorry. He and his government have been sitting on 12 long years of reports. All Howard cares about is getting control over Aboriginal land. Do you think that Bennelong was angry? Yes, he was angry, and they didn't even tell him that they were going to take all the land, and then in the year of 1976, well, the Australian people voted to make him a citizen in his own land. Aboriginal people get shifted to the bottom of the deck all the time. Why can't there be an Aboriginal statue by an Aboriginal sculpture near Bennelong Point, say in Elizabeth Bay Park, which is being redeveloped right now. I saw books for sale at auctions that tell a different story, a different history to the one taught to me at school. Why can't these early books be in a whole library in every school? They tell about the way the land was taken and the severe and horrible way that the Aboriginal people were treated. Unless people know the truth about Terra Nullius and the settlement of this continent by modern man, they will never change their stereotype views. This early history needs to be available to Aboriginal and Australians so that we can fit into this urban society and feel good about our history. I had a dream that I did not have to sell my paintings so cheap to collectors, to gallery owners, or to the white boss. Judgment by his peers is a real Australian story. I painted this in 1978 while serving a life sentence in prison. I believe I would not have been sentenced at all had I been judged by an Aboriginal jury. In British law, each man is judged by his peers. When I asked to have one or more Aboriginal people on the jury, well, one lawyer said I wasn't white enough to be white, and the other lawyer said I wasn't black enough to be black. And this was so disrespectful to my family, especially to my two Aboriginal grandmothers. So now when someone says to me, you don't look white or you don't look black, I just say, are you calling me a wog, are you? Judgment by his peers is an oil on canvas, painted in 1978. It is for sale now on my website. I have a dream to keep my best paintings. Then somehow I couldn't stand to sell other blackfellas' paintings cheaply in my gallery, and I tried to keep the best of their work, and it turned into Blackfellas Dreaming Museum. The name is Blackfellas Dreaming, one blackfellas dream. It's my dream. Well, my gallery and my museum was a financial failure. So now I am selling the most precious artwork of my museum, Judgment by His Peers. In 1995, the Minister of Aboriginal Affairs, Robert Ticknor, called Judgment by His Peers a national icon. I have this in writing. I need a studio, a place to paint. I need to pass on my dreams to the next generation to fight for our basic rights, to have our true history told, to have a free-standing museum with real history books and artworks that has a lot of Aboriginal curators, Aboriginal storytellers, Aboriginal dancers and Aboriginal security guards, and a whole lot of trainees coming through, graduating from our programs, a job for every Aboriginal that wants a job. If the Iraqi war never happened, well, think how much money could have been put into supporting the arts in this country. If I am successful and sell Judgment by His Peers, then I will create an artists and writers retreat out of my home and large shed on 10 acres of land at Magnetic Island, Queensland. Artists and writers need support, so it will not just be for Aboriginal people, so it will be multicultural. I hope it will be a place where Aboriginal people can have a lot of jobs and be able to exchange ideas and techniques, where we can have a bushboxing ring and families are welcome. Magnetic Island is the next island to Palm Island. Some of my paintings are about Redfern and a link from the country to the city. Redfern is a stepping stone for the Dreaming Man. And the Dreaming Man is one of my paintings which I do. And the Dreaming Man is about an Aboriginal man that comes to Redfern. The Big Smoke. He comes from the bush to look for a job. He is surprised that Redfern is not as nice a place he is to form and there are no jobs, no money to get back home. His chances of being stranded on alcohol, drugs, or the police is great. He dreams of London or New York, but most of all, he dreams of home. He is stuck and cannot get anywhere. Well, that is me. a self-portrait, except now I have been invited to exhibit my paintings in Paris in September and Dubai in October this year, 2007. I paint about Aboriginal history and the black-white relationship. What causes Aboriginal deaths in custody? Why are the jails full of Aboriginal men and women? Why are Aboriginal people so angry? Some jails are more than 50% Aboriginal, yet Aboriginals are only 1 to 2% of the population. Through my paintbrush, I can tell stories, titles like The Poisoning of the Waterholes of Australia, Living Conditions, It's a White Man's World, Everly Street 1, 2 and 3, The Gender of God, The Death of Nita Blanket, Protest at Old Parliament House, The Black Bastards Are Coming, A Toast to the Federation 2000, The Successful Taking of the Land by Queen Elizabeth and Prime Minister Howard, Where the Wildflowers Once Grew, Here Comes the Judge, Aboriginal Fairies for Aboriginal Kids, and I'm a Dreaming. The two paintings of mine at the Beijing Olympics are titled Terra Nullius and Invasion Day. I paint portraits of the emu. The emu is very special to Aboriginal people. I found Bill Arney, an Aboriginal author and storyteller in Katherine, Northern Territory, and he told me about other names Aboriginal people call emus. One was Featherfoot, and I also remember my grandmother's stories about the Featherfoot. It was about an emu that could change and was very clever, like a Cleverfoot. These emus carried messages and warnings. The Gadachi men are very wise and cover their tracks. They wear emu feathers on their feet. The male emu sits on the eggs and then raises the young, while the female goes off to breed again. In times of drought, they drop their eggs and do not hatch them. The emu has been pushed away from where the urban cities are, just like the Aboriginal people. The emus had to live and survive with the invader. I just don't paint dots, and I don't feel comfortable with it. My paintings are urban or contemporary, as they tell the true stories that what is happening and what I remember about the past. As an Aboriginal artist, I feel a responsibility to paint the truth, and these paintings reflect the society in which I live. Living with the invader is an urban problem that Aboriginal people have to deal with and cope with. Living with the invader is now living with turning on the news and listening to our Prime Minister invading our Aboriginal communities. Every time I listen to the news, I feel like rewriting this speech. Living with the invader is something that all Australians need to come to grips with. We still have a long way to go. Urban Aboriginal artists are at the forefront to expose the continuing plan to usurp our culture, to take our land. So hopefully, through our art and our stories, our voices will be heard. And thank you for listening to me. Thank you.
Sam Watson is. Beg your pardon, Sam. His talk's Insertion, Reseeding the Landscape with Indigenous Identity. And he says this about himself. Samuel Watson was the winner of the 1999 David Nyapon Award for Emerging Indigenous Writers for his first collection of poetry called Of Muse, Meandering and Midnight. Since then, he's written three more collections, Itinerant Blues, Hotel Bone and Smoke Encrypted Whispers, which won the 2005 New South Wales Premier's Book of the Year and the Kenneth Slessor Poetry Prize. Samuel's opera, Die Dunkle Erde, is that the right pronunciation? The Dark Earth, premiered in Brisbane in 2004 and was performed again in 2005 for the Brisbane Music Festival. Gee, we're getting some hot stuff here, ladies and gentlemen, aren't we? Welcome, Sam.
Thank you very much. And I'm just bringing up a slide of some of my poetry as it looks on the handrails. So it's just one word, of course, but if any of you do visit Brisbane and get a chance to walk over the Green Bridge in Dutton Park, you'll find my poetry in the handrails. and in various other places in Brisbane. So once again, thank you to Peter. It's a real pleasure to be down here with the National Gallery and be in, once again, the backyard of the boss of the enemy, Canberra. sorry, my mind's a bit blown from the session this morning. It was a very good session. It's just upsetting that there's not more local people here from Canberra. In fact, I was saying at lunch, it's last week when the decision came down in Townsville about what happened on Palm Island, and the man who was as Uncle Gordon was saying, he was tried by his peers, and once again the Indigenous community and the family had to pay for what he did. You know, we could only get sort of 100 blackfellas, and people knew for a week that we were going to march on Parliament House. Yet every Christmas in Brisbane, there's a black public servant's Christmas party drinks. And you find out, you know, there's about 1,500 young blackfellas that work in this city in Brisbane in identified positions. Yet we could only get maybe just under 100 people to march on Parliament. So I suppose that's one thing about the complacency of some of our people who do live in the cities. And living in the city, it's always said to me, I mean, we're at the coalface of our enemy, and I say enemy with the full intent of its purpose. Growing up, I learnt sort of some very iconic things about being an urban Indigenous person. The land rights flag, the red, black and yellow. Terms like, is it justice or just us? What do we want? Land rights. When do we want it? Now. I suppose those things all came as part of the day-to-day, weekly political expression of our people. Sorry, I'm going off track here. I've been sitting down and working on this paper. I've been doing more work on this paper in the last 2 weeks than my own writing, and it always explodes into this late-night polemic that goes off and gets to points where I'm blaming the CIA for Kennedy's assassination and stuff like that. So I'll try and stick to this. I'll try and stick to the points at hand. So as you can see there from the photo, I, as a poet now, I'm finding more ways to get my language out, my voice out there. This one thing of inserting poetry into the landscape, I suppose for me, it's placing back an Indigenous presence in a landscape that has up until not long ago been ethnically cleansed of our people. If you look at, and if you come up and visit South Brisbane, I can remember when South Bank, which is now one of the richest parts of Brisbane, tourist mecca, it was a whole riverbank of corrugated iron sheds. My father's mother was, in fact, an oyster shucker there in the 70s. So basically our people are being taken away, removed from this landscape. So poetry like this and projects I have been working on with Brisbane City Council, I'm finding they're giving me free rein to place these things into the environment. As far as the significance of the art movement, well, definitely the artists I see are definitely some of the people who are at the forefront of our political movement at the moment, and they're sorry. I had a whole talk organised here. I'm losing my place. Sorry, I can't speak as eloquently as Richard Bell. One thing I can say though about the art movement, and especially in Queensland, one anecdote is when I was doing some consultancy for Arts Queensland, I was given the responsibility of creating an arts and cultural reconciliation strategy. And I thought, well, this is great. I'm finally getting to do something which may, in fact, be helpful to Indigenous people. And one day, I just happened to be in Arts Queensland's archival banks, and I found there are actually 7 authors before me who'd also written an arts and cultural reconciliation strategy that had never been printed or put before the Parliament. So thus, my statement, arts and cultural statement, reconciliation strategy, has never gone before a Queensland Parliament. And basically, one of the things I wanted to put in my strategy was that the government would at least crack down on the trafficking of Indigenous art. Not long ago, and I've written widely about this, my mother, who is constantly fretting about my financial situation as a writer, she found in the Courier Mail Classifieds an advertisement that said Aboriginal artists wanted, no experience necessary. And which is just a ridiculous statement. But basically, the Queensland government was offering employment subsidies for certain galleries on the Gold Coast if they could prove they had Indigenous people working on the floor. They could get these subsidies for the Indigenous people. And basically, up until then, it was backpackers. They were just getting print. They were just getting Western Desert art and turning it into doilies, turning it into all sorts of things. So that was one of the things I really wanted to attack when I worked at Arts Queensland. I was basically told, don't bite the hand that feeds you. The first instance, well, who would have come up with something like that? And I said, well, you guys have been doing it. It's been the Queensland government that's been actually propping up these galleries. So, So as far as I'm usually a better speaker than this. As far as the significance of the art movement, I mean, the artists, as I said once again, they will always be on the front line when we are facing off, when we are getting our message out. As far as how can Indigenous cultural material be better read as a documentary text, I've thought about this and thought about it, and I don't really have any answers on that one. Although I do believe it would be a great employment opportunity if academics were serious about collecting stories that, especially the people on communities who are storytellers. Basically, I forgot to bring the poetry that is on those poles, but the good thing about what the Brisbane City Council has done with the bridge is they conducted a cultural audit, and they not only interviewed Indigenous people and traditional owners of the area, they also found people who'd lived where the bridge had been built, that generations of people. So basically, the poetry is it signifies the river and one important thing about that area, you'll just see on the left-hand side of the screen that there's part of the word Kurilpa, and Kurilpa Point on the Brisbane River. Kurilpa is both a word used by the Turrbal and Turrbal and Yagara nations. The Kurilpa was the water rat that was thought to be extinct from the area. It wasn't until the new Gallery of Modern Art was opened later this year that pest controllers were called in, and they were asked to catch these sort of weird-looking rats that they've been finding in the new museum. Turns out they are these water rats, so they are coming back to the area. Part of the poem talks about the ghosts of the Kurilpa and how they're coming back. Once again, I'm totally sorry. I've written all these notes, and none of them seem to make sense. But basically, as a writer and a poet, I first started out by not wanting to be a political. I didn't want the responsibility of being a political poet. I just wanted to basically entertain. The work I have done now, though, I'm finding more and more younger people are picking up my work. They're coming to my work on a weekly basis. I'm conducting workshops in writing poetry, and there's a younger generation of writer, especially in Brisbane, and I'm meeting more and more kids who read my books on the HSC in New South Wales that are more open to the idea of acknowledging Indigenous people as the traditional owners of this country. So that does give me hope. And as I said the other day at the AusLit conference, if the powers to be aren't going to give us justice in the courts, then I'll steal the conscience of their children with my writing. Be like the Pied Piper and just come through and take them all. That's basically what I want to do with my poetry. And once again, I'd probably leave it for the question time. I'm really sorry. I must seem ill prepared, but I do have all these notes, and I've been sitting up late at night with my two brothers who are both on holidays at the moment. And once again, we start off with this talk about Aboriginal culture and identity, and somehow we end up at late at night after three bottles of wine blaming the CIA and what they're doing in the Middle East and the oil companies. So I'll probably be better for a question and answer at the end. So, look, thank you very much.
Those points that Sam didn't manage to make, well, when we come and have a yarn later on at the end, I think it's the time to do it. Stephen Hagen, his talk is An International Perspective on Urban Migration of Indigenous Peoples. He's the 2006 NAIDOC Person of the Year, internationally renowned author, academic, filmmaker, commentator of race relations. He writes for the Koori Mail and works as part of the Kumbaring Ngurrpai Lag Higher Education Centre at the University of Southern Queensland. So welcome, Stephen, and the podium's all yours. Thanks.
In 2005, I went to the Sydney Writers' Festival. In fact, I had my first book launched at the Sydney Writers' Festival. Anita was present that day. And as I was walking up Senator Aidan Ridgway, I think I got him a couple of months before he finished his term, which I was quite lucky. Walking to my particular session that day with my family, I heard this voice, a familiar voice, and there on this boat was young Sam Watson. And I'm an accidental author. Mind you, I've written three books and I've got two coming out in the next 6 months, so I guess I'm past the accidental stage. But there was Sam speaking, and he was the most eloquent speaker I've ever heard. So I was quite surprised to see my brother up here today, but anyhow, that's another story. But I would suggest in future for Sam, because on this particular day, Sam was sitting on like a floating barge and was rocking. And Sam was entertaining a crowd sitting on the barge and those sitting back on the pier. And it was so good. So I think maybe if we had some rocking of the boat, Sam. But anyhow, I was most impressed with Sam then, and I continue to be a very good and admirer of Sam. In fact, I spoke with his father, Sam Senior, at the Woodford Festival a couple of years ago. You've got to be very careful when you say you're speaking with Sam Watson, because there are, in fact, five Sam Watsons. And you need to have a qualifier on those who are listed on the timetable. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of this land, the Ngunnawal people. I spent 15 years of my formative years, straight out of year 12, out of university into Canberra. And I've got very fond memories of my time in Canberra. It was where I learnt to drink seriously during the liquid lunches. I no longer drink. It was where I learnt to gamble seriously during lunch breaks, which I no longer gamble. But so my wife was saying to me, because I've got to stay on for another conference on Tuesday. I think Peter's got a conference at ANU on Tuesday, which I'm also speaking at. And she said, oh, you should have fun in Canberra with all your old friends. And I said, that was about 20 years ago. I said, they're all probably in the same category as me now, and I think we'll all be rather boring if we got together and tried to reminisce about the past. Although on your paper you've got me down as speaking about international urban migration, I'm going to divert a little, although I will touch on the issue of international migration, urban migration. I guess Barbara, and I thank Barbara and Margot for inviting me here, because I think Barbara read one of my pieces in the Courier Mail. I'd just come back from Santiago, Chile, where I addressed the UN Habitat on urban migration. And in fact, it's quite a complex story because there's not a lot of data around about the flow of urban migration. So what I'd like to do today is I'd like to do a personal perspective of what I can consider to be urban migration. However, my talk is more about, I call it the migration of racism. I think to understand where Indigenous people are today, you really need to understand the dynamics of their environment, which is basically, reiterating the words from my colleagues this morning, is one filled with racism. Before colonisation, Indigenous people living on country coexisted peacefully with their 300 neighbouring tribes on a vast landmass comprising over 7,500,000 square kilometres. Just to put that into proper perspective, to drive from Melbourne to Darwin would be the equivalent of traversing a myriad of sovereign countries between London and Moscow. Although there are numerous stories of successes and failures of marauding tribesmen in pursuit of conquest, it would appear, in the main, that the 300 divergent traditional boundaries had minimalist impact of such actions over 100,000 years of Indigenous occupation on this continent. This utopian lifestyle had no magical formula that one acquired through consumption of abundant flora and fauna presented from a pristine smorgasbord or from breathing purified air, but rather a simple formula that governments of all persuasions ought to heed hastily in order to correct the present social anomalies. And that was a good old-fashioned word of respect. Respect for neighbours' rights to their land, their culture, their languages, and importantly, respect for their most vulnerable members, women and children. Sadly, this ideal lifestyle came to an abrupt end when on the 25th of January 1788, Captain Arthur Phillip sailed into Botany Bay from Portsmouth, England, with the First Fleet that consisted of 11 ships, 290 marines, women and children, 717 convicts, supplies of pork and rum, equipment and livestock. Sadly, the traditional owners, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, were not afforded any respect of their land and customs from the white people who set foot on their country at that time, but rather endured the extreme opposite, contempt and savagery of attacks on their people, the likes of which they had never countenanced before. Fast forward 100 years from that first violent conflict, and what do we have? The end product of experiencing the might of a foreign race of people saw Indigenous Australians, in most parts of the country, living in parlous, dysfunctional and powerless state of mind. Traditional owners were forcefully relocated from their country to make way for pastoralists in search of prime land for their expanding sheep and cattle interests. There was resistance on all traditional lands, some that lasted weeks, while others required the intervention of the military, who spent a significant sum of their war budget engaging in strategic manoeuvres for decades. Notable names of Indigenous resistance fighters include Pemulwuy, Windranein, Yagan, Tadawali, Jundamurra and Mosquito. With the absence of law and order in the frontier, Indigenous people had little protection of their traditional rights and repeatedly fell victim to foul play, especially their women, folk who were exploited in the worst possible manner. The growing number of children from these forced liaisons caused discontent within the broader white community, and in an effort to remove the evidence of rapes that occurred at will and the occasional consensual unions, hastily introduced government policy of separation of non-full-blood children, half-castes, from their mothers came into effect across the nation between 1915 and 1969. Other policies conveniently legislated prior to and after the Stolen Generation era were introduced principally for the purpose of removing Indigenous people from their traditional lands to pave the way for a smoother transition of white interest on their land. Those not sent to mission reserves, like my father and mother, lived a life the best they could on the fringes of towns in humpies. Their only form of income was from the minimum wage earned by working cattle and sheep on the land that was once owned by their forebears, or toiling as domestic servants, scrubbing dirty floors, pots and pans in the sprawling homesteads of white landlords who grew fatter in wealth and girth by the hour. 1967 referendum. By now, the electronic media was able to venture into the rural and remote parts of the country to film the contrasting lifestyles of the first Australians and the recent British arrivals. And for many, the images that beamed at them in their land rooms from their small black and white television sets were disturbing, to say the least. Many black and white leaders grabbed this window of opportunity, perceived interest from discontented white Australians to the plight of Indigenous Australians, and through their concerted efforts won a landslide victory of almost 91% in a referendum vote called by the federal government to end them controlling power over the states on the welfare of the most marginalised sector of society. As with most oppressed Indigenous groups around the globe, Indigenous leaders in Australia, including my father, sought and won hard-fought battles for basic services for their respective communities. These were political efforts of exceptionally visionary leaders who risked their own safety to challenge the status quo of racism that permeated every facet of their daily lives and that which was fiercely enforced by civic leaders since colonisation. Dad was a hard worker and, like all new leaders of his era, sought to provide a better lifestyle for his family than the one afforded him when he was growing up. Around the time of the 1967 referendum, he borrowed money from his boss on the cattle station as a deposit and successfully applied to the bank for additional finance to purchase land and build a house on it in the white township of Cunnamulla. Dad was the first Aboriginal man to relocate from the French camp of 300 residents with his family to the exclusive white township. But at what cost to traditional roots? A decade after successfully watching his house take shape from pouring of the concrete foundation to the nailing down of the floorboards and enjoying running water and in our septic system and electricity for the first time, my father had to move to the city to further his career and provide better education opportunities for his children. It was also around this time when motorisation depleted work in the pastoral industry for loyal Indigenous workforces. Motorbikes and helicopters replaced stockmen. Dishwashers and vacuum cleaners saved on a wage that crept up to the award level for Indigenous domestic workers over time. Australia suddenly saw a significant migration of its Indigenous population to urban centres for work and to be closer to better essential services that weren't readily on offer in rural and remote areas: health, legal, education, housing services, as well as a variety of and cheaper groceries and white goods. 30 years on, and like father, like son, I sought to provide a better life for my family than the life I recall as a naive but impressionable teenager. Even though I own a four-bedroom house on acreage land, drive the latest SUV, and send my children to private schools, there is one constant in my life that continues to stand as an identifier and a major hurdle for many, and that is my colour. In Australia, colour often equates to racism for most Indigenous Australians, irrespective of profession or status. If Indigenous people move from rural areas to urban areas in the hope of escaping the palpable bigotry that experienced on a daily basis, then sadly their respite was momentary, if that at all. Most of humanity will soon live in cities, and the trend of global urbanisation is irreversible. Cities in general are seen as the engines of economic and social development, creating jobs as well as generating creative civic cultures. Cities today, however, can also generate and intensify social exclusion, limiting the benefits of urban life to the poor, to women, to youth, to other marginalised groups, including Indigenous people. The majority of Indigenous peoples globally still live in rural areas, but the limited available data shows that more and more of them are voluntarily or involuntarily migrating to urban areas. This migration can be temporary or permanent. Thus, the global urbanisation process is increasingly affecting Indigenous peoples in many countries, both in developed and developing countries, with diverse impacts. The lack of full respect for human rights for Indigenous people continues to be one of the most serious obstacles to the improvement of their living conditions, forcing them into escalating levels of migration. Their rights are oftentimes violated when the in transit and often arrival in a new and often foreign environment. In many instances, Indigenous people are subject to pressure that results in the migration of the general population, placing them in more vulnerable conditions due to the daily situations of poverty, segregation, and discrimination. For those Indigenous people who wish to escape the rat race and return to their traditional land to re-energise spiritually, again, bad luck, as the government has also made it extremely difficult to make connection with one's land, as new and enshrined rights favour pastoralists and mining interests over those who had sovereignty on their land, traditional lands, for eons. And what of those people who choose to remain in urban areas in the hope that circumstances will change for the better in the future? Well, they may see some education and financial improvements, but in the main, they will encounter insurmountable challenges to their authority for their children from competing interests such as the iPod, PSP3, Xbox 2, etc. Try asking impressionable teenagers to go for a drive in the country to make connection with the land in preference to a school dance where all their buddies are decking themselves out in the latest African-American rap subculture attire to wait the pulsating sound of gangster rap from blaring speakers inside schools' gymnasiums. Well, at least you can save on the petrol, as you've got next to no chance of winning over Indigenous urban youth with such competition. Indigenous people who enter into the migration circuit for the reasons mentioned face important challenges that, while not different from that forced by immigrants in general, do have specific peculiarities related to their ties to the land. The lack of opportunities of their cultural and language development in urban areas, or changes in their health due to changes in their customary diet. But they may remain small challenges, but they remain more small challenges against the myriad issues that confront them daily on urban streets, especially those pertaining to racism. So we should just throw our hands in the air as parents, or should we fight our parents before us to take control of our families and our community? We need to organise ourselves into a cohesive unit, stay resolute and united, and do like our people did pre-1967, and gain support from our white brothers and sisters who share our dreams and aspirations, and utilise the media when and wherever possible to sell our dreams. As Lewis Menin once said, the evil of modern society isn't that it creates racism, but that it creates conditions in which people who don't suffer from injustice seem incapable of caring very much about people who do. And whether we remain in the country or choose to move to the city, we should continue to hold our heads high and fight the scourge of racism in order to provide a better lifestyle for our children. After all, our children, whether they are rural or urban, are our next generation. And that makes the fight even more important. Thank you. I would, if you want.
Were they real? I mean, like...
Everything's real. Everything's real.
Of course they were.
Which one do you want to see?
That one.
Yeah, they're all real. Look, for those, I shouldn't be actually saying this, but I've just my wife and I, my wife is a Innes Vale lady from where Burnham comes from, Mamu lady, and we just did a completed a documentary. There's been a documentary done on my campaign, as some of you may be aware, with the Nigger Brandstand. And we got an opportunity through the Australian Film Commission and ABC and Australian Film Finance to do our own take on my campaign. And so we did. And I didn't want to do one like Julie, the famous Aboriginal producer and director Julie Nemo did. So we did a documentary on my campaign. And what we did, we gave the sign. The sign is called the ES Nigger Brandstand. It's a sign on a wooden stand in Toowoomba. We did a documentary on a talking sign, but it's not the talking sign that has a personality. We gave a personality to the word nigger in the sign. And we initially had John Howard from Sea Change, who was going to do the narration for this word nigger and give it the personality. And the documentary is titled Nigger Lovers, and it was going to be Nigger Lovers narrated by John Howard. We thought that would be a good marketing tool. But John had to go off to Fiji and film something else. So we got another guy, and as they say, we got lucky because the narrator of this new documentary is John Jarrett from Wolf Creek fame, and he is far more racist and old and evil. Anyhow, this Tuesday I've been asked to... they're doing a screening for at the Sound and Film Mob up here. It's a 26-minute documentary, and if any of you locals are here, ring up Liz McNiven, and come along and watch it. We've been invited to... We're premiering it at... It's already been premiered at the Opera House. We're going to the Melbourne International Film Festival at the end of July and the Britain Film Festival, and we'll do Sundance and Cannes and several other international films. But we would like it to be... Well, it's an ambition, of course, to be a signature film on racism. And we look at this, and if you think you're worried about these images, we actually had a coup in that my fellow producer, a non-Indigenous guy... He actually interviewed, I think it was the first interview done by this guy, the Imperial Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, who lives in Sydney. And he actually talks about how to bash up blackfellas. He tells you exactly how to do it. The preferred one is to hang them or drag them behind a car, he says, but the other one is to get a bit of PVC pipe and put a red thing around the end, make sure you don't wear gloves so you don't leave any prints, etc. And this is all articulated in their documentary because he thought he was sharing this information with another redneck fella, but he was a bloke getting information for a documentary. So that's all there. And in fact, it is so controversial. I'm very worried about they're talking a lot about it because the police have already heard about the documentary. They've already asked for our DVD because they want to get this guy under the new legislation about inciting violence. So I hope they don't take this part out of the documentary because it's quite a dynamic documentary. Well, I think it is anyway. Oh, it's already been finished. Yeah. It's going on ABC nationally. If you've missed it next Tuesday, it goes nationally on ABC. Next Tuesday at the Sound and Film Archive. It's for all the Australian Film Commission staff. I think they've got an office here. Are you with the AFC? Are you?
No. I was just gonna.
Elizabeth McNiven. I don't even know whether is that the office she works for. Just tell her that Steve Hagen said you're coming as a guest of his. That's all. Just say you're my guest. I don't know how big the hall is. But so if I keep saying that, I'm sure she's going to be shocked when everyone turns up.
Since we're getting into sort of general discussion, maybe you could invite the other speakers to come along the front here, please. Mm-hmm. Hadn't quite finished this morning's discussion as well, I think. So if you want to pick up points from this morning and discuss it with our speakers here or what they were saying or whatever, including those words in front of us at the moment, well... So keep the discussion general, and we've got some roving microphones again. I think Anita's going first. Thanks, Anita.
I just wondered if that letter was CC'd to the mayor, and I wondered whether or not the mayor publicly distanced himself from that letter.
Well, in fact, this is where it's very, very frustrating. I'm sure a lot of Indigenous people have had this experience. I first took this issue to the mayor because she had me working on some street kids campaign in Toowoomba. I said, look, I'm very offended by this nigger on the sign. I said, I would like to take it down. She said, Stephen, when I became the first female member of the Toowoomba Sports Ground Trust, she said, I also raised this issue because it concerned me. She said, why don't you write a letter into me and I'll put it to the board and get it taken down. Well, just so you understand the power of civic leadership in this country, she took it to the board, and the board pull on the line and said, you obey by our laws, or you can go. She moved the resolution for the maintenance of the sign. It almost broke my heart, I think. And then she then took me to court. I've been to the federal court. I've appealed to the full bench of the federal court. I sought leave to appeal to the High Court of Australia. And that, if you think the High Court judges are pretty cluey, well, Justice Mary Gordon, the only female justice at the time, she dismissed our case in 20 minutes, and she used the analogy of, if I was a pink person, should I be offended by a pinky porky cement truck, to dismiss the offensiveness of the word nigger on a sign? And from that I then took it, because I've exhausted all my legal avenues in the domestic courts, I then appealed to the Committee for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which is CERD, at the United Nations. And in 2003, I was successful. The United Nations ruled that the word was indeed offensive, and for the state, which is Australia, to take the appropriate action to remove the offending word. Guess what? Darryl Williams, the then Attorney General, and John Howard said, no, we're satisfied with our domestic courts, it's going to stay. And so that's why this campaign has been so long. But surprisingly enough, for those who will come on Tuesday, and don't forget I'm talking immediately afterwards at your thing.
You're right.
I won't miss your session. They said that it wasn't offensive to them, and you know, the sign stays. And this time around, I'm now being bankrupted. They've now taken an application against me to bankrupt me. So I have several businesses. I have businesses overseas. If I become a bankrupt and the ruling is pending, it should be coming out soon. I'll lose my passport. I'll lose my right to control my finance. My family and I, we lose our house, our latest Jeep Cherokee, Land Cruiser. We lose all those things because I dared to fight the establishment over a racist word. And I was also the fellow who challenged dairy farmers over coon cheese. And I've done a lot of research, and it was going to be one of my PhD subjects, but I've changed. I'm doing another topic. But that's another... And dairy farmers soon after sold their shares to Kraft sold their interest to dairy farmers because I've actually exposed their fraudulent activities, particularly in relation to their patent laws.
I suppose there's nothing our conference can do in the way of resolutions. Probably a bit useless, isn't it? Is there?
Yeah, look, this thing's been ongoing. It's very... in fact, the government has... they've actually... sorry, I don't want to take up the good gentleman's time here, but the stand is coming down now because they reckon there's white ants eating things. not black ants or red ants, it's a white ants. But that's only because the government is embarrassed by me, and they're offering them $2.5 million to build another stand, and it's pathetic really, because they don't acknowledge the effort I've done. The sign will come down, but now they're going on about we'll build a statue, and we may call it Edward Nigger Brandstand. And I said, well, you'll see me in court for another 8 years if you put nigger on that statue. So this is institutional racism. It's just something that they just won't shack out of, you know. I mean, and I mentioned in my speech the importance of working with our good white brothers and sisters, unlike my brother Abby before, who had some other contrary views on white people. I think our success will only come about by engaging non-Indigenous people in our battle, because you guys know the system a lot better than us, and you know how to network with these guys. And people kept saying, Hagen's using all the taxpayers' money. Well, I don't know whether that Jewish lady is still here. Yes, there she is. I had two lawyers. I fought these guys for 8 years. The first lawyer I got is a Greek guy, and his name now is Peter Black, because he had to change his name because his father had trouble in the war years because he was victimised for being Greek. And so he changed his name, and he knew what discrimination was. But to get into the defence cases, I really needed a barrister, a Queen's Counsel or senior counsel. And I got a very prominent barrister from Canberra, and his name is Ernest Willine. And he came on board because he's Jewish, and his father experienced concentration camps in Germany, and he came out here, so he knew what it was like. So both those guys worked free of charge for me, and so it was just a campaign of engaging with good white people to fight these guys. Oh, look,
Well, if you become a bankrupt, I suppose I might like to get a little scooter or something to ride around. No, but look, thanks, Robin. Thanks very much for you.
Yeah. Go on. Where do we go next after that? I don't know. Who'd like to either add to this discussion or ask our other panellists a question or whatever? Bronwyn's going to have a go, I think. Thanks.
Hi, it's Bronwyn again. I suppose that's an interesting thing, Stephen, like in relation to growing up in a small country town, because when we talk about urbanisation and people moving to the city and stuff like that, when you do have the thin edge of the wedge in a country town, like when my dad got married to my mum, well, actually got my mum pregnant, her uncles threatened to horsewhip Dad out of town. He was not allowed to, one, be with a white woman, two, and the family wouldn't accept him. And even today, like in Tenterfield, like, it's extremely racist, you know, town, because it's actually people are allowed to continue to be that way. You know, aren't they? You know, and that's one of the reasons why I moved to the city, because I go back to my country with my cousins and everything, and I've got, you know, Aboriginal, continuous, handed down Aboriginal. We've actually got native title, which is continuously handed down in our family because we've always kept our land. But there is that thing of moving away from the intolerance of being in those smaller country towns. I mean, I just admire you because I know Toowoomba really well, and I just can't imagine how you can.
I think the other thing too, Bronwyn, I think it's a bit like Sam and all the speakers up here. We're all success stories, but I don't want us to be success stories. I want us to be the norm. You know, people say, well, why do you fight so long and hard? See, my grandfather, when we forced off our traditional lands, we moved into the fringes of society. The white people said the blacks were incapable of learning, they can't control their finances, they're ignorant, they're subhuman, all these sort of nasty things. My grandfather ran a grocery store on a fringe camp, those humpies. We had no running water, nothing. You know, the dead in Cunnamulla were cared for better than the Aborigines. In the cemetery, in Dad's time, they had four taps. The white people used to drive in on Sunday, fill up their little vases and put the flowers in, go and get another bit of water from the taps and water the little grass plots. And they had a security guard at the cemetery to stop Aborigines jumping the fence and stealing the white fellow's water for their dead. There are no taps for the Aboriginal people, 300 Aboriginal people living on the fringes of society. So if you can understand those appalling circumstances, then you've got my old grandfather, Albert Hagen, who had the audacity to set up a grocery store, no running water, no electricity, and the white businessmen can only go there and exchange, you know, selling the non-perishables, the rice and the tin meat during daytime because there's no electricity and all that sort of stuff. So he almost forced the white businesses in town out of money because he was getting the money off the so-called blacks. And then you go fast forward to Dad, and he went into town. But then my dad, and people would be aware of this, he became chairman of the National Aboriginal Conference. He was the first Aboriginal to address the United Nations in Geneva. Yeah, and that was over Noongumba, when Charles Court went to mine on Noongumba in 1980. And then I later became a diplomat myself and went overseas. So we're talking about generational changes here, and all these people here and before me, we're talking about real change that's happening. But even though we've had three generations of working tirelessly to change attitude, this country is so hard to change attitudes. It's just so hard to change people's attitudes. And this room should be packed with the array of talented speakers, you know, and listening to all these wonderful stories. But yeah, that's the way it is.
Before we go to another question, maybe our two panellists, would you like to add anything to the conversation at the moment?
Yeah, please say something.
No, I've...
You happy?
Yeah. Only anecdotal stuff.
Sorry? Okay, we had to do another question then. Thank you.
My name's Julianne. I'm actually a host here at the museum, so I'm pretty honoured to be sitting in on this afternoon. Going back to Samuel, sitting here, being at the coal front, like you say, here in Canberra, and I'm definitely a white fella with black on the inside, let me say. So, guys, from your perspective, from an Aboriginal point of view, growing up in a really racist country town, and now sitting inside a city, having lived in third world countries as well, and lived up in Kakadu for some time, from you guys, how do we, other than the way I be, by being human, continually keep trying to change the attitudes of what you're just saying? Because to me, you know, that's how I live my life. And we need to make it generational. It can't be just rhetoric, and it can't be just... It needs to be from, you know, how we live it with our children. Any other suggestions, guys?
You're saying how do you make changes and you grew up in a country town? Well, I grew up in a country town. Yeah, but you're talking about making changes, and the changes happening in the big city, don't they?
Where I've come from, the folk haven't changed. And people here in Canberra don't change
that much
either.
You really want to make change? Educate your primary school children. Mm. Make sure they look at all the history books. Mm. Don't let Professor so-and-so have a book worth $1,000 or $2,000. And that rich man's got that book. He puts it up for auction. Another rich man buys it, puts it away in his cupboard and sells it off and looks at my valuable book. Why don't they get the books and reprint them and put them in all the primary schools so the little children can learn all about the true history, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And until we face that, people are not going to respect each other. They don't give a damn.
I suppose I have a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old who have blonde hair, blue eyes, and they're also Islamic. They're constantly challenged about their aboriginality, and whenever we have marches they also carry the Sinn Féin flag to acknowledge mum's mob, who are Irish German, and now and then they turn the German flag upside down so it's sort of more like the Murray flag. But it is education. I think one thing I really love doing as a writer is engaging the little ones. My partner's a documentary maker, and she did a very short documentary on Boundary Street in Brisbane. If you look at the old UBD of Brisbane, there's a seclusion line. There's a number of fractured boundary streets. And in the old days, well, up until 1965, we actually have records of black American servicemen on leave from Vietnam who were caught in the crossing the boundary, and Bjelke Petersen's police pulling them up and saying, "Hey, get over the line," you know. They changed it in the 1967.
Sorry, when you count out people behind, you can't hear you. Sorry.
So when I show that documentary, and it's amazing that, and it's from the last group of school kids who I thought would really, it's the private schools in Brisbane that are inviting me in. The sons and daughters of all the cattle cockies and that, who watch it and they go, "Man, must suck being a black fella. Do you feel like going down Boundary Street with a baseball bat?" And I say, "Well, it's not the point of going down Boundary Street with a baseball bat, because who am I you know, it's not a point of revenge or avenging anything. But it gives me a lot of hope when I do walk out of those sessions, where the kids, the teachers trying to herd them out, and the kids just want to sit there and they really take it in."
I would like to, in answer to that question, my dream is to hopefully one day, because if you can recall your history, sitting beside a lot of historians here, the white people opposed the Greek and Italian migration, and even during the Second World War they rounded up and they were counted and all that sort of stuff. There's records on all these Greeks and Italians. But they were soon assimilated, and they got their business and economic base going. So they allowed them to come in and be assimilated. And then the refugees and the boat people, the Vietnamese came into Australia, and they were opposed, and their rights were violated. But a generation passed, and then they're accepted. They're the doctors and lawyers and the grocery, all those people. But at the bottom rung of the ladder all the time, and one of the previous speakers spoke about it, Paul Murray still stays down at the bottom of the rung. Mm. Why can't white society give us a bit of a break? Let us be the Greeks of the 40s or the Vietnamese of the 60s. Let us get into society. I don't like the word assimilation. I don't believe in assimilation. But let us have the same respect as they afforded the new arrivals.
My concern is for our kids. It is for two reasons. It is about how they're going to deal with their identity, how they go forward. Our census statistics show that more and more mixed marriages, we have more and more children identifying as Indigenous. It is, the numbers are certainly being boosted, not just by people choosing to identify, but because we are expanding through mixed marriages. And the government is then using this terminology of urban and looking to direct funding away from urban. I think it was an interesting point made this morning that the term urban is a substitute term for talking about half-castes, quarter-castes. Mm-hmm. It is a way of defining us. It is a way of dividing us. And if they're using that as a term to divide us, how do our kids go forward with that? The government is saying, the Commonwealth Grants Commission found a few years ago, that money must be directed at those most in need. Those most in need are defined as those in rural and remote communities. So in excess of 50% of the money goes to those in 30% of the country, or that in 30% of the population. I mean, we heard this morning at least a fifth of the population lives in Sydney. I mean, I think it is that the biggest Aboriginal population in Australia is living in the Mount Druitt region. And yet, under current government policy, defining them as urban means that mainstream services are left to deliver to them. That is, all of those things put together, this is an identity crisis, an issue facing our kids, and about how we take forward the services. And to me, that is a really, really crucial thing that we need to grapple with. I, like everybody else, am very disappointed at the numbers that are here today. I think that this issue needs a lot more airing, and I think we need to have a lot more people, and a lot more people, as was mentioned this morning, by, I think you said it, Sam, sitting in identified positions in government. I'm one of those people. You know, I've been 35 years in government, most of those in identified positions since they created them. I moved into one in 79. I'm one of those Koori's who can stay in government. I come and go. But it won't stop me fighting. I have a sign on my wall that says, beware the death of ideals. And at the moment, I'm continuing to still fight for those ideals. And I think it's something we have to keep on about. So, yes, I know the focus is about... there is a need to educate non-Indigenous Australia, but we have to deal with this new terminology of urban and focus on it for our kids. Thanks.
Thank you.
Any comments from the panel on that?
Well, just for myself, Oriel, in fact, it was Oriel's husband, Patrick, was one of the first blokes in Cunnamulla when he was out there as a government official from Brisbane or Cherbourg to Cunnamulla, who actually went in and fought the segregation laws. He asked to buy a ticket and sit where the white people sat, because in Cunnamulla, like all cinemas, there was a roped-off area up the front where blacks sat, and after that roped-off area, there were just reserved slips, and you couldn't sit on anywhere. Even if the cinema was empty, you just couldn't sit past there. And as that was our only form of entertainment in the early days, of course, we didn't want to rock the boat. We had nothing else to do except go and watch the cowboy movies and the war movies. But also, just addressing Oriel's comment, I think we all have a responsibility to our own families. You've seen my two young children here. They both go to private school. My wife, she's also an academic at a university. We're both Indigenous. And we have no problem with our kids staying with their rich white friends. And the white parents of the kids don't have a problem them coming to our house. Mm. Our house is full of Aboriginal painting, you know, the possum paintings, a whole lot. They're all there. Not as many as Margot's, of course, in her nice, lovely big house in outer suburb Canberra. But what we want to do is we want our kids to grow up having aspirations of living a better life than that of my father or that of myself. And if they want to espouse middle-class, upper-class views, well, we'll encourage that. But we also take them to the Dreaming Festival. We take them to the NAIDOC Award. We take them to the message stick things. We take them wherever we go. And I get invited to go to a lot of conferences. And I say to a lot of them, I said, look, I want my kids to come to my wife. You pay for them. They say, we don't have the budget. I said, fine, I won't go. And on the marches, we take them on the marches. So our kids see the struggle, but they're not losing sight of where we want them to go. And I don't have any regrets about them doing that. So I think if we can all take care of our own backyard and try to get our kids the best education possible and exposure to a wider range of views, I think not only will they go forward, but they'll bring their school friends and their classes forward with them.
Thanks. And that picks up Anita's point, as you mentioned, about socialisation as well. Same sort of thing, isn't it? Right, who's got the mic now? Please.
This is my name's Elaine Saren, and this is a question for Sam Watson. I believe you won the New South Wales Premier I'm not quite sure. Can you tell us about that? Because you're from Queensland.
The Book of the Year.
Was that, I mean, you're Aboriginal and you actually won it? Can you?
Yeah, I don't know. I still think it was rigged. It was quite funny that night because I beat Tim Winton, who's one of my heroes. The funny thing was, the next morning I ran down to Sydney Quay to get the newspapers because the media had sort of jumped all over me, and basically there was a photo on the front page of Tim Winton's big night in Sydney, and right at the bottom of the article on the second page was and Sam Watson won the Book of the Year and Ruby Langford was given an honorary award. Yeah. Who are these people? You know, there was no real explanation. So, I mean, it was also when Alexis Wright won the Miles Franklin last week. There was hardly anything. Basically, only Alexis had to generate her own publicity as such. So, you know, once again, it's just getting our voices out there. Winning a Book of the Year gets me into schools. It gets me to talk to kids. I don't want to brainwash anyone's children, but just give them understanding that it's okay to come up and ask me if you need help. I'm not a threat. My father's not a threat. My children aren't a threat to your way of life. I think one of the craziest things that, and I actually wrote this down in my notes, the day the Mabo decision happened, and people like John Lawson, Stan Zemanek got on Talkback Radio and said, "Your Hills Hoisters under threat. Your Yards under threat." Well, now it's really moved on. We've moved on since Mabo. Has anyone had their backyards taken? Are the Mabo family any better off? You know, I don't know anyone in the Mabo family that's got a million-dollar yacht or a flash resort built on Murray Island. Mabo really hasn't put us anywhere forward. And I think that the fact... being a person from the city, I'm quite and not having any connection to traditional country, I'm quite sceptical about native title, anything to do with native title. The fact there were no Indigenous people on the High Court bench when native title came down, the fact that native title wasn't a system that we had in place since the dawn of time. So, yeah, once again, sorry, I went off on a tangent there, but once again, education, I think...
Sam is a classic example. Sam's dad would be one of the most highest visible Indigenous activists and advocates in Australia. You see, whenever you see the Mulrunji case or anything, Sam's dad, also Sam Watson, is to the forefront. But Sam and his young boy, in order talking about... And his wife is non-Indigenous, and you know, and Sam's sister, they're marching the marches, but she's a very prominent academic, a barrister, an academic in Sydney. So we, this new generation of Indigenous people coming through, we can mix it in any circle, as well as walk the streets and still be proud of our own people. But I understand what Oriel and others are saying, but there's a lot of our people who would much rather identify with the Americanized culture than the Aboriginal culture. And there are a lot of people who shame to be black, and they'd much rather pass off as Indians or Maoris or others. We're trying to say, look, you can still be black and proud of it, you know? You can still aspire to all the big things as well without being shamed of your own culture.
The thing is, what gets me, though, with the media, they call my dad an activist. He's just an Australian that's just questioning the system. My dad doesn't sit in dark rooms with other guys wearing berets going, "Right, we're going to meet here. I'm going to park the truck there and bang." Dad really doesn't do that. He comes home and sits, you know, after his day out working in the community, he comes home and puts on the plasma TV and watches the footy and gets up in the morning, has his Weet-Bix. He's not really into taking the government down, but challenging. And, I mean, I can see Dad's frustration because all the people that he came up with in the Labor movement, the union movement, are now in charge in Queensland.
That's right.
Peter Beattie was... Dad was there the night he was beaten up by Bjelke Petersen's thugs, and Beattie goes and gives the guy who, you know, licensed his police to put him in hospital a state funeral. I mean, geez, I would have just gone to make sure the old booger was dead.
Okay, we've got a question from Barb and then Uncle up the back there, I think, please. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Okay, Barb.
Just quickly, Sam, I just wanted to ask, because both you and I, Mananjali, we come from Brisbane. As kids, we did all the marches throughout Brisbane. This is regarding your comment that you made in your talk, the fact that now, especially since, like, 1999 and 2000 forward, most of the marches that are happening in Brisbane are very small, and you know, there's you're getting about 100 or you're getting about 200 people, whereas Brisbane, especially during the 70s and 80s, were the most notorious, you know, rallies and marches that went through. And you know, you and I were both kids, and we marched there. We were little kids waving signs as well. And it's strange now as adults when we went back when I went back to Brisbane from South Australia in the 90s, and when we had our NAIDOC marches and that, I was really amazed to see, hello, we actually fit quite comfortably in the street. How did that happen?
Yeah.
You know, where before we were sort of bursted at the seams as a rally group of people marching through, and the voice just sort of, it was still there and strong and resonated, but it didn't have that same sort of as many people doing that, just coming out. And then having, you know, like you said, you've got all these people who are working up in jobs, public service jobs or private sector jobs, they're there and they come out for Christmas drinks, but they're not coming out to do the marches.
Also, though, I mean, to a lot of the younger people whose parents may have not been politically active, I mean, to an observer, we are hitting our heads against the wall. I've sat through three Royal Commissions now. You know, those coppers, they just get off and they get elevated to other positions, so they get taken out of uniform, so we don't recognise them on the street. You just sort of wonder what it's all for. I mean, so I could see a young Indigenous person who has never really been interested in the political process, I could see how they could view people like Dad and people like Uncle Steve sort of hitting their heads against a wall and not getting anywhere. But I think you said to me, as long as you're in the fight.
I think there also comes the element of comfort. I think a lot of black fellows now in the public service, in particular, are comfortable. You know, they don't all. I think Richard was saying to me before. He said, I think all the hard fought battles have been won in terms of us getting in jobs, whilst we've lost ATSIC and a lot of other things. The public service, as a large population base of Indigenous workers, and I think a lot of them are comfortable, and I don't think they feel the urgency to get out and protest on the street like their forebears did, and a lot of the people doing that. I think, and it concerns me the high level of complacency. You go into some meetings with some people now, and you don't recognise them. You say, "Who are you, brother? Who are your sister? I've never seen you before. How come you in charge of all this money now?" They got no understanding, no empathy. They don't understand what the person on the other side of the table really want to do with the money. They're there because they either come through the university systems and they avoided the political struggle and they got there. No matter how they got there and they're in charge. And they're also Indigenous. And I just want those people who are in that position to start understanding how did they get the opportunity to get where they are. It was the street marches. It was the people who did all that in the early days. I mean, I don't mind wearing PRK in clothing. I don't care about that. But I was still marching in the early days. I'm still where I am now. Why can't they also have pride in their people and compassion for their fellow Indigenous people who are not as comfortable?
Well, who was the next?
I'm sorry. I'm going back to your comment about urban and regional remote. And just in relation to art centres, I don't know. Bamali, which I've been involved with, just had the 20 years. It's been struggling for 20 years, and we tried to get it reclassified as a regional gallery because under the arts industry, and you'd all be aware of this, but there's, I mean, I've participated in, written, been involved in probably, you know, 8 or 9 reviews of the Aboriginal arts industry, which, mind you, has remained static at $200 million a year for the last 20 years, which I think is really interesting in terms of auditing and, you know, how you say that, you know, how do they back this stuff up? Well, no one actually did an audit about how much the Aboriginal art industry is worth. But we've never been able to get Bamali classified as a regional. Therefore, 42 art centres throughout the Northern Territory
and Queensland get funding, and Bamali, which is probably the, you know, the only Aboriginal run gallery in New South Wales, as for regional people, can't change its classification under government rules. So they miss out on funding continuously. They don't can't get enough money to actually support their artists properly, and they don't have enough money to actually, you know, pay for the fluency of their the people that they employ. So this you know, conversation that you're saying we should be having, we've been trying to have it, but I think if we have it more with amongst each other, then we can push for greater change, because we do have people that are, you know, going to go into government and make, you know, have some inroads, have influence.
You're saying that's with the Aboriginal Arts Board and not...
Oh, arts. No, I don't... I actually stay away from all government bodies and have never affiliated myself with anything pretty well. I'm just really a standalone person, grassroots, but I do see that governments need to change their minds in terms of the arts boards, in the terms of the way that they organise things, because at the end of the day, you know, as we say, 70% people don't live in regional or remote areas. Yes. And without social and cultural relevance, you know, what are you doing? You know, you can't go in and have a look at your artwork at the New South Wales Art Gallery, because I'm a New South Wales artist and I don't get my work up there. But, you know, you can... Well, they hang cliff, you know. You know, you end Mu, Papunya. It's nothing... It's against the strict structure of what's actually in place. But it's also a conversation that needs to be had, because, hey, I'm never going to get collected by the New South Wales Art Gallery. That doesn't faze me. I'll still be a critic, because at the end of the day, I'm a New South Wales Aboriginal woman. I've come from my Jarman clan, and I'm proud of my cultural heritage, and I want my other countrymen to see what I've done, to be proud of the fact that my dad wasn't even allowed to be educated and I've just finished my third degree. And I ain't anal, you know? I'm just a person who wants to push the boundaries of education to just see how far we can perform. So I think it's these conversations, not again personalities, but about general representation in our communities and in the mainstream, that needs to be addressed, because too many people are scared of criticising other Aboriginal people, and I'm not.
The point I wanted to build on two points. One was made by Sam, and that is the fact that a lot of our younger ones, and I want to relate this back to the identity between the discussion about rural, remote and all that stuff, a lot of our young people, when they see what's happening, et cetera, and they see all the negatives, they ask themselves, who wants to be black? I don't want to be black. And that's a phenomenon that's not only being felt by our people, it's being felt by a lot of the Africans who are coming at the moment, or the Vietnamese, and the kids are saying, I just want to be an ordinary Australian. Because if I'm an ordinary Australian, hopefully people won't see me, and I can move through the system, and I won't cop the crap that's happening to my family. The other part is that there are a number of things that that need to happen, and Wesley talked about this morning. We need challenge, and I was really surprised. It's the first time I've heard this in a joint form of both male and females, and no one really picked up on it. And the issue of the debate when it comes about identity and who we really are. Us mob haven't had that debate yet. Us blackfellas. And that's what's one of our major problems. And that's the cause for a lot of the crap that you guys are getting. It's because us mob as Aboriginal people haven't really come to terms about, well, who are we really? And for a long, long time, some of us, when I was in higher education, we tried to start the debate by talking about heritage blacks and genetic blacks. Who are you? And that got squashed in the head. No one wanted to talk about, I'm black because this is my blood, and cultural black. What do you mean cultural? What's Aboriginal culture? So we tried to start the debate. It was stifled. And that's one of the reasons why we are where we're at the moment. None of the black people in this country really want to talk about other black people. They leave it to the white fellas to shovel us down the pit. And then we can say back, well, it's the white fellas' fault. Rather than what's been said here today is there are opportunities for us now to make the rules and say to the people, no, I'm not Indigenous, I'm not Aboriginal, I'm this. Oh, okay, and then they'll have to accept that rather than say, well, oh, no, you have to be one or the other. And same with this rural, remote and whatever. Does this mean you're less than Aboriginal? Rubbish. And until they hear it from us, It's really difficult. And I think there was a comment made earlier about academia as well. Until we push those boundaries, the academics will stay with the common ground crap. They'll still say, the name of the game is thus, therefore you must do it this way. And unless we challenge them as Aboriginal people and support these challenges, we're going to still be sitting here in 30 years' time saying exactly the same things.
Yeah.
But the most important thing we must always remember, and that is who owns the gold makes the power. You know, if the government is the person or the group of people who can impact significantly on the social well-being of a community through injection of finance, if they're not listening to us or to the grassroots Murrays, nothing will get done. Look what happened after ATSIC. I mean, I was the first person to come out publicly that I'm aware of who advocated the demise of ATSIC. I advocated the demise of ATSIC, but I asked for it to be replaced by another representative body. So what they do, they got their own hand-picked body and they rubber stamp it. And, same with this, what they're going in Northern Territory with. They've got two Aboriginal people on that. And I think they're both connected with the NIC. So no matter how much we have this debate, I can't see 1,000 black folks around Australia going camping at Old Parliament House like they did in the early days at the Tent Embassy. The comfort zone is there with a lot of us now. And also the realisation that the government's net, particularly this ultra-conservative government, they're not going to waver, brother. They will not waver to cries from outside that system. And that is the most frustrating thing to me, because I write every fortnight for the Courier Mail. And I've made a lot of comments, even when I criticised an old bloke for interfering with his 15-year-old bride, and I said it was manifestly, too short a term for his sentence. I was attacked by an Aboriginal head of the legal service in Brisbane saying, butt out of customary law, as if she supports a minimum sentence for a man who violated a 15-year-old bride. This is a problem we're having everywhere. And I agree we must talk, but it is very, very frustrating for people who can't get the ear of the government. It's very frustrating. It's like young Sam said, you would have thought 1,000 people would have walked in Brisbane last week after hearing the Hurley case. Less than 100 people turned up. It's very, very frustrating.
We've got time for one more question from Christine, then it'll be Smoko, I think. Where you go?
Okay. is this on? Right, got it. I want to come back to something that Stephen said, actually a couple of things, about getting comfortable. You know, where have all the protesters gone? That, you know, Barbie was saying, you know, there's 100 people turn up, and they've been subsumed by the mainstream. You know, they're comfortable, and, you know, as Brother here was saying, you know, they don't want to stick their head up above the parapet. Why would they? You know, they're comfortable where they are. And I think that might be the same mechanism as what happened with the Lady Mayor. You know, why is that a local Labor government?
She was supported by the unions and got
Right, exactly.
My biggest hassle back on that case, the reason why I lost all those court cases and it lasted so long was black people came out and supported those white people, the white civic leaders, who said the word nigger wasn't offensive to them. Mm. Now, the word nigger is offensive to them, but guess what? Conveniently, a month before I started my campaign on Nigger Brown, I asked for accountability and transparency in all the organisations in Toowoomba. And since then, everyone was closed down because of million-dollar rorts. I asked for accountability and transparency. They then cited, with the white people, to attack me on my legal campaign. They were my biggest obstacles. And you'll see it in the documentary if you come. Sam's father is on the documentary, and his lovely sister, who's a barrister, is on the documentary. And they were my biggest obstacles. And like brother talking over here, you will come up with the most beautiful and most practical solution to Indigenous issues, but you'll have the other black folks on the other side attacking that proposal because it's not their proposal or because they had a fallout with someone years ago and it's an opportune time to get back at them. It's that level of insensitivity we're dealing with.
What I'm heading to, though, is, you know, there's a mechanism operating where people are... You know, they want to go into the mainstream or they want to sort of not put themselves up to be, you know, victimised. And I imagine a woman working in a political context that's run by the unions would be in a position where she'd be, you know, not wanting to stand out or to toe the line. And I guess the point I'm making is that there's a kind of moral authority, really, that needs to be held by people other than those with agendas about power. because they're going to be swayed by other interests, you know. And the moral authority, I think, is held by the artists, and it's held culturally, so that, you know, Sam and Vernon, you know, have got a really important role to play in politics, not just in culture, by holding the moral authority that we can kind of aspire to, because, you know, what happens when that falls apart? You know, what are the ideals, as the lady down here was saying, you know?
Just a quick response, please, from whoever wants to have a go.
Just very quickly, and I'll let my panel members also have some comment. I have a writing on my wall, and it says, "Knowledge is power." And another one underneath that, it says, "A home without books is like a body without a soul." And I think the only way we can have this change, this generational change, is through education. And that's why people like Anita and Sam, we're into the writing game. I left all the organisation. I don't belong to no organisation anymore. I write and I make movies. And I'm achieving more by writing children books, fictions and non-fictions, or fictions on its way, but non-fictions. And more people are reading our work. And the conference that Pete got next week is about autobiographies and biographies. It's about telling the stories. So what if we've got a small crowd here? If the publication comes out from Barbara and Margot, it can be disseminated, and people who didn't turn up can read about it. We need to get our message to a broader group of people, and I think it's through education that we'll bring about change.
Well, I reckon...
Sam and Gordon, we're going to wrap up on something, brother?
I suppose the trouble is, what I see happening a lot with Aboriginal people is it's all about just taking the power away from Aboriginal. I suppose I might sound like a racist when I say this, but the white fellow's got too much power in Aboriginal affairs. He makes the rules, and the Aboriginals have got to skip the rope, sort of thing. And I think that Aboriginal people have got to start to take over their own culture and be in charge of their own affairs and make their own decisions. And the trouble is, you see a lot of if Aboriginal people could practice their own culture, that'd be a job for every man, woman and child, but there's not. And you see, I see so many people who are working in Aboriginal areas and saying they're Aboriginal and not Aboriginal, you know, and things like that. And I don't care who you say you are, but long as you are who you say you are. And they take positions of power away from Aboriginal people. And, you know, that takes a long, long time for it to get rid of it. You know, and they say, educate the people, educate the people. I've been hearing Pete saying, educate them, educate them, educate them. But us natives are so stupid, it must take a long time to educate us. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, this country's been settled for over 200 years. Surely there's some educated Aboriginals around who can teach other Aboriginal people. Mm-hmm. You know, you go to see where the Aboriginal people are getting educated. And you see the white fella is in charge, you know, straight away. He's the boss. White boss, the white boss. It's the old mission mentality. It's still there. It just won't go away.
Yeah. I had to laugh the other week. My 10-year-old came home and he'd failed his social studies exam. And I said, what was your exam on? He said, Aboriginal culture. And I had a look at all the answers, and he had all the answers which sort of applied to our family, but didn't apply to the curriculum on the sauce, the Queensland sauce. And he was like, I said, why didn't you study for this? He said, I know everything about being a black fella. How can I fail this exam? So, but once again, yeah, culture. And I mean, I was going to bring it up earlier. The funniest thing that has ever happened in my life is when we found out halfway through high school that we were entitled to ab study, and we got sent this form, proof of Aboriginality. And I just looked at this form and go, what do I have to do? Go in there and shake a leg, hey! Or something, you know. Rub some sticks together in the Social Security office. But, it's little things like that we're still facing with, but definitely education, I know. I thoroughly enjoy working with kids, teaching them about the wonderful simplicity of writing, and that being writers, they do have the power to help. I still believe we're really far away in this country from a real proper solid identity. And that's what I try to encourage kids to do, I suppose. Well,
I don't seem to think it's... I don't know about identity. I think it's just if they just got to respect people's rights. Everybody's got to have rights. But Aboriginal, shove him under the deck and bring him last. Just do what you're told, boy. And that's about it.
Well, I think we've kept up the high standard this morning, don't you think? We're on a real roll here. Thank you, panel. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.